Afternoon. I'm going to call this meeting of the Housing Finance Policy Committee to order. And note, we have a quorum present. First order of business, Vice Chair Agbaje, have you had a chance to review the minutes for March 19th, 2024?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and so moved.
The minutes are moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 19th are approved. We have four bills today, and the first one up is House File 4613, Representative Purcell. Representative Purcell, welcome to the Housing Committee. Since you're not on this committee, I will move that House File 4613 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. And Representative Purcell, I understand you have a DE1 amendment.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Please just briefly describe the DE1.
Yes. So because of timing for our session, I appreciate you letting me present this bill here, but we will not have time to bring it to Judiciary or to HHS. So this amendment makes it so this is a one-stop shop.
All those in favor of the DE1, say aye. Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, the DE1 is adopted. Representative Purcell, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair Howard. I'm honored to be presenting House File 4613 as my first bill before this committee. My friend Senator Kupek asked me to carry this bill in our chamber because a constituent reached out to him, whose story I will share with you shortly. Due to timing, as I mentioned, the DE amendment was made to reduce the number of committee stops and that the bill must make this session. However, you may see me back before your committee next session with a bill that builds on the concept, at the very least, that someone can, at least with this bill, get out of their lease if and when they're renting and there are high levels of radon. Many people, including myself, are unaware before this bill that radon is a leading cause of lung cancer, and consequently not enough is being done to prevent exposure, especially among people living in rental properties. Tenants typically lack authority to make changes to their units without their landlord's approval and may fear that raising radon concerns could jeopardize their tenancy. Because we have seen increased federal support for radon action and several state and local policies have given us examples, this is a great opportunity to pursue policy change here in Minnesota. I'm going to share, because we could not have this person come from Moorhead to share his personal story, I'm going to share a brief testimony and story from the student who Senator Kupek spoke with that this bill is thanks to. My name is Milton Hilligus. I attend Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. For my junior year, I plan to live off campus. Due to the heightened levels of radon in the basement bedroom, I am unable to live in my rented room. My friends and I are college students, and this is our first renting experience. We did not know the legally binding questions to ask our prospective landlord. And visually, there was nothing wrong with the property. So we signed the contract in May of 2023. We were not informed about the radon. I did not live in the house over the summer. My room was subleased to a fellow student. When I attempted to move into the house for fall semester of 2023, I found a radon detector the previous tenants had left us. The detector had registered a one-year radon average above 12. I was unaware of the existence of radon before this moment. After brief researching, I realized it would be hard to find a form of temporary housing until the radon issue was addressed. The plan was to live on campus temporarily until the radon issue was fixed and pay on campus and rent until then. After all, it would be more affordable if it was just a month or two. However, by the end of the fall semester, there was no progress to solve the problem. My landlord made no attempt to observe or address the issue after months of back and forth communication. By winter break, my savings had been fully exhausted. Breaking my lease and living on campus was financially impossible without taking out additional loans. I had to live in the house. Currently, one of my roommates and I share a room. My basement room is vacant as the radon levels fluctuates between 4 and 18, consistently above healthy limits. Desperately for less a cramped living situation, my roommates and I routinely contact our landlord to address the issue, if not even for us, but for the next tenants. Our landlords only question the validity of the numbers we recorded from multiple testing methods. After our landlord had an emotional outburst over text threatening to sue if we provided our personal opinions of her housing stock to fellow students, she gave in to test the radon level of the basement on her own. I have not been informed of the results of her independent test. However, in the following weeks, she sent us links to conspiratorial websites and forums downplaying the severity of radon exposure. She promised us with a fine that the house was fine and all houses have radon, and told us to think for ourselves. This was in reference to our citing of resources such as the Minnesota Department of Health, the EPA, the HWO, the WHO, and the CDC. I'm still paying rent. My lease ends in a few months, and I will be gifting the future tenants our radon detector. And that is the reason for this bill before you today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. We have two folks sign up to testify. First, I have Professor William J. Angel. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I have a vocal cord issue, so if you don't understand me, please interrupt me. Chairman Howard and members, my name is William J. Angel. I'm a professor emeritus of housing from the University of Minnesota, where the last 30 years of my 47-year career, I served directing a U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Regional Radon Training Center that served the north central region of the U.S. I've also served as president of the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists. Furthermore, I'm an active member of consensus-based national standards development in radon for measurement, mitigation, and new construction. I chair one of those groups, and it's done under the American National Standard Institute. Finally, I have served as a visiting scientist at two federal laboratories, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and the Radiation and Indoor Environments National Laboratory, as well as served on the World Health Organization's International Radon Project. First, let me say thank you for your service on this critically important committee and your consideration of this bill. Today, I come before you to ask for your support of File 4613, calling for Minnesota rental housing property owners to test for indoor radon according to national standards, disclosing the results to tenants and prospective tenants, as well as, when appropriate, to reducing unsafe concentrations of indoor radon concentration. While my position is consistent with that of being an internationally respected scientist, my motivation to come here is really personal. I lost a 38-year-old brother-in-law, never smoker, to lung cancer. The most likely cause of his death due to lung cancer was exposure to radon in his homes. I also lost my wife's mother at 62, who never smoked, to lung cancer, and the most likely cause of her death was her exposure to radon in her home. So I come both professionally and personally in terms of dedicating myself to the protection of tenants from this invisible radioactive gas. Exposure to radon in Minnesota's rental housing units is responsible for about 180 lung cancer deaths per year. By comparison, there are about 35 residential fire deaths per year in Minnesota and about 14 accidental carbon monoxide deaths in all settings in this state. And you can see that radon in homes kills far more than residential fires and accidental carbon monoxide deaths. It's a serious issue. If you assume all Minnesota carbon monoxide deaths occur in residents, which of course they don't, then we could state that radon in rented homes kills more than three times as many people, again, has accidental carbon monoxide exposure and in homes and residential fire deaths. Over a 75 expectant primary economic service life for dwellings, this means that the state's rental housing stock is responsible for roughly over that service life 13,500 lung cancer deaths over that 75-year period. This bill addresses that issue. The cost of radon-induced lung cancer in Minnesota is about $260 million per year, according to the National Cancer Institute, of which $73 million per year could be attributed to the radon-induced lung cancer in rental housing. This bill addresses that issue. One might ask, ensuring safe indoor radon exposures are maintained in Minnesota's rental housing is an environmental justice issue that's been ignored for far too long. One might ask, why not simply encourage tenants to test their homes for radon? Renters, of course, as just you had the example, are in an incredibly weak position to fix any radon problems they discover, and the tight housing market does not reasonably allow them to move to another home with safer concentrations. There is a proposed amendment to this House file that calls for tenants to test radon in their own homes and to terminate the lease if the landlord fails to respond. In addition to the issues I've just mentioned, this approach in multifamily rental housing does not assure protection of other tenants in the building, and it violates national consensus-based standards calling for 100% measurement of ground-contacted units. This approach further violates the Minnesota Department of Health's administrative rules for licensed radon measurement providers. So I urge you to vote no on the proposed amendment. Today you have the opportunity to ensure 650,000 Minnesota families who rent can be reasonably safe in their homes from radon-induced lung cancer. Please support this bill. I welcome your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Leanna Stefaniak. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak with you this afternoon. My name is Leanna Stefaniak. I am the current board chair of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I've worked in the multifamily industry as a housing provider and licensed attorney for nearly 20 years. And I'm here today just to offer a few of our concerns about the function of the statute, not the concept of the statute, just some areas that we think needs to be cleaned up as we move forward. But first, I want to recognize the story that Representative Purcell shared just a few moments ago. It's beyond unfortunate, and we are truly empathetic to the situation that resident described to you all. As professional housing providers, we do regularly test for radon in our buildings, whether that's at time of purchase, it's at the financing, the refinancing, and that does usually require 100% testing of the ground units at the property. So we are familiar with testing in our industry, but again, we just have some concerns about the functions of the statute as proposed. Namely, the proposal requires that the housing provider does a professional test, but it doesn't make that same requirement for the tenant. And we believe that any testing for radon at the property should be done by a licensed professional. That would help alleviate some of the concerns that we have in the test, because the professional licensure has specific locations that they know to test, where they should test, the living situations, the portions of the rental unit that needs to be tested, and so forth. Without that requirement, we're also left to question whether the efficacy of the test that was purchased, a Home Depot test versus a licensed professional test, they're not always the same measurement. And by having licensed testing on both ends of it, alleviates some of those concerns. Further, if there is a positive test, there are two options in this bill. One is to mitigate the building or the unit, and then the other is to terminate the lease. While the proposal does give a 90-day timeline for the tests of the housing provider, it's unclear what we do when the two tests that are received, the tenant's test and the landlord's test, what do we do when those two tests are in contrast? So something to clean up that portion of the proposal would be helpful. In the situation where the test does recognize an elevated radon concentration, there's questions on how long we have to mitigate. Is that 90-day timeline from the original tenant test? Is it from the date that the landlord got their test? Is there additional time for that period? So, again, what that time frame looks like as we move forward in the event that there is a positive test, that's clarification we would seek with this proposal. And then finally, obviously terminating a legal contract is a significant action. We believe the proposal should provide specific notice language that the resident needs to provide if they're going to exercise their right to terminate the lease. That kind of procedural process would make this proposal more in alignment with other statutes in 504B that already pertain to a quasi unilateral right for a tenant to terminate the lease, such as what we do in the domestic abuse statute, the infirmity statute, and other ones. So those would be our concerns that we do have. Again, in concept, we understand it and we're sympathetic to it, but we just think to move forward, these items should be addressed. Thank you for allowing me to share my concerns.
Thank you. Next, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Purcell. One question I have for you, or it's maybe for the testifier. You know, we had a similar bill for a different type of, you know, gas last year, and I'm just wondering, with radon inside of an apartment building, I was reading some of the documents here that it can be at any level. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, when you find it at one level, then do you, I mean, mitigate it all the way up through? I mean, I've done one for my folks in their townhouse where I didn't do it, but we found it and we got it remediated. I'm just interested how you address that from a bigger picture.
Representative Purcell.
I don't know the technicalities of that. If I can phone a friend.
Sure, absolutely. Welcome back to the penny.
Okay. Would you restate the question, please?
Go ahead, Representative Myers.
So the question is, you know, if you have a five-story building and you have it on the third floor, typically then do you remediate? I mean, can it, A, happen all the way up there, and then do you have to remediate all the way down, or is it, do you typically see the whole building has to be remediated?
It varies building to building. That's why the national standards call for all ground level units to be tested and 10% of the units above. Normally, radon mitigation would consist of applying a technique called active soil depressurization to the soil under the building. And that is routed then outside the building, ideally above the roof, but a minimum 30 feet above the ground.
Representative Myers.
And thank you for that. You know, Representative Purcell, really good concept here. You know, we're always trying to look to make these bills, you know, operationally sound as possible. I'm hopeful you're, you know, willing to work with the other testifier on some of those concerns, especially if there, you know, there's a conflict in testing, if we can, you know, put kind of everybody on the same field that they do the professional testing. Because again, I've done those. I actually have one of the Home Depot tests in my truck that I was going to do 2 years ago, and I never ended up doing it. So that's probably where maybe if you're willing to work with other testifier, I would appreciate that. Thanks.
Representative Dodseth.
Chair Howard, our representative, and while the witness is there, I guess the question I would have is, does ventilation make a difference inside the home if there's windows open, things like that? Does that help reduce the rate of radon in the home?
Dr. Angel?
Yes.
Professor Angel?
The answer is maybe.
Okay.
And in fact, depends on what windows are open. You can increase indoor radon concentrations by opening some windows.
Representative Dodson.
I guess I'll do a follow-up question on that. To your knowledge, is there a widespread issue with radon being found in rental properties? Is there evidence that's proven that actually shows that there's an uptick in that, or where is this information coming from?
Professor Angel?
Yes. More than 20 years ago, in 1989, Minnesota Department of Health participated with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and did a statewide survey, which indicated roughly 40% of the occupied housing stock in Minnesota was at or above the U.S. EPA action level. And the risk at the action level for the general population, your risk of lung cancer is 1 out of 50 of contracting and dying from lung cancer. So it's a terrible risk.
Representative Dodson.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Question, I'll just do a follow-up. Will this be, this bill impacts 504B, will this be considered for judiciary as well as we move forward?
We did touch base with judiciary. It doesn't add any new civil penalties, so it does not need to go to judiciary committee.
Okay, thank you. You know, I think we all admit that there's always concerns. We want to look at the best health interests of everybody. A question I've got is the data registry of this. What is that going to look like as we move forward if this were something that would be in place?
Representative Purcell.
I'm not sure I have an answer to that, and I touch base. I know the Minnesota Department of Health is here, too, and so just touch base with them briefly about trying to figure out the best way to do that. I am open to suggestion.
Very good. I look forward to working with you on this. I'm just concerned that this bill is not quite ready yet, and I guess this may be a slight overreach as far as impending on landlords. I guess I have a little concern about the way this bill is written right now. I'd like to see some more work done on this as we move forward. Thank you.
Representative
Cha. Thank you, Professor Angel, for your work in this particular area. I have a two-part question here. One is, how much does a Home Depot kit cost versus a professional test kit cost, and what's the accuracy rate, I guess, between the two?
Professor Angel.
Yes. Mail order test kits, or those sold on the retail market, are roughly averaging $15 to $25 each. Professional tests in multifamily buildings would be around $120 on the average nationally. So there's a difference. The major problem with the do-it-yourself placement of tests is that it may not meet national standards of proper testing, and it gives you the opportunity then of having either a false negative or a false positive.
Representative Cha.
Thank you for that remark, and thank you, Representative Purcell, for bringing this forward. It's the number two cause of lung cancer in Minnesota, and that's unacceptable, so thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and some of you know that I have lost a few wives to cancer, and one of them was lung cancer in a house that we lived in which she never smoked, and so we did a radon test, and it was about double, I think it was close to 9 or so, and so we did mitigate it, and I did a lot of research as to figure why, because radon is actually a type of radioactive gas that naturally occurs. It occurs when rock degrades from become a rock into other pieces, and I think it's like the fourth or fifth on the level of its degradation, and so it happens, and it's a gas that just permeates out through the ground. Normally, when it goes in through the ground and out into open space, it's never of high enough concentration to be of concern, but it can pool in basements, et cetera, for a lot, and that's one of the reasons why when you hear windows could actually make it worse, because it creates negative vacuum in the building, which then draws that gas inside the house. And the mitigation for single dwelling, single homes is usually pretty simple, as if there's drain tile around the house, you just create a pump to pump air out of it, creating a negative pressure, and so the gas follows that and it blows right out into the air instead of going into the house. When you get into commercial vehicles, it gets a little bit more difficult, but radon is out there, and it's strange because your house could be high, and the next house next to you may not have any radon in it at all. It isn't something that just, there's a whole section of town in which it's that way. Back around when she passed away, Channel 11 did a lot of that and was giving out free tests. That'd be around 2008. And so it's something that we do need to be considered of. My only question is, when we have contracts and you are given the authority to break contracts, to me, it's, even though there's no cost to it, that's something that usually judiciary does involve with. So passing that on for just your thought. Thank you.
And thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Purcell, for bringing this. I am a renter. I have been renting with being a mom to my little one who's going to be turning 5 next month. And when she was 2 years old, I learned even more about radon just because it kept popping up into me thinking about buying a new home around in our area, let alone that we lived in a rental duplex that our landlord had a delinquency of even checking for a radon test. So researching all of this and me going to purchase a Home Depot and recognizing there was radon in this home and deciding there's radon in the home, whether you rent it or it's an old house that you put quite a few of a large down payment for that they're requesting. I just want to acknowledge that this is not something that we need to not think about, that this is super crucial when we talk about tenant rights, when we talk about the responsibility of landlords who have been delinquent to serving their tenants, when it comes to the safety of our children. At times, this is reflective of dignity of humanity. Today's my grandmother's birthday. She lived to be 103 years old, and I'm grateful for that. She suffered from lung cancer. And she never smoked, but we did researches in the factories that she came to work in New York City by way of her homeland of Puerto Rico, that the levels of radon were immense. It was just impeccable, the ratings of how much was being in that area. So I hear what Representative Petersburg states, that there could be radon in one home and not in the next. I think it's the actual care of the home and how you can have resources to minimize that accuracy of what radon is floating in the air, because it's proven fact that folks, whether you're in this state or a state that has old structure of stone, which was made clear, has cancer floating around it by way that we're breathing in it, let alone in the homes that we're living in, whether we're renting them in a duplex, whether it's an apartment residential or a house that we're purchasing. So thank you so much for recognizing those victims through bringing this legislation that have suffered, that maybe have lost their lives, and the families who did not have the accessibility of interpretation services, and so much that we see come through this committee, because this is important to raise awareness for not just my district that is seeing it, but also for our entire state of Minnesota that is seeing it, from the cities to greater Minnesota like yourself and our farming towns. Thank you.
Representative Purcell, you get the final word.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Thank you to all the committee members. Thank you to our testifiers, and especially to Milton Hillegas, who very bravely shared his story as a young adult so that we could address this issue. I have a feeling you might be seeing me back here next year to perhaps add some more teeth and certainly get more clarity on this process. And I am absolutely this weekend going to buy a radon test for my own home, which I just started renting in August. So just everyone, thank you for sharing your stories and for your vulnerability and for your expertise. So thank you.
With that, I renew the motion that House File 4613 as amended be recommended to be placed in the general register. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no.
No.
The bill passes and moves on to the floor. Thank you, Representative Purcell. Up next, we have House File 4010, Representative Kozlowski. Would you like to move your bill, Representative Kozlowski?
Yes, Chair Howard, I would like to move the bill.
Representative Kozlowski moves that House File 4010 be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. And Representative Kozlowski, I understand you have a DE1 amendment. Would you move the amendment? And it probably makes sense to move the amendment and then describe the bill. So I'll just call for the vote. All those in favor of the DE1 say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The DE1 is adopted. Representative Kozlowski, to your bill as amended.
All right. Thank you, Chair Howard and members. It might feel a little like deja vu hearing House File 4010 on its own standings today. I just wanted to start by acknowledging that today is Homeless Day on the Hill, and this room is filled, and the Capitol halls of power are filled with our relatives, including well filled up with the Luthians here advocating for those who are housing insecure and experiencing and being unsheltered. And I think that's very fitting and grounding for what we're doing today. Today also a new report came out from the Wilder study that shows rates of homelessness and housing instability is worse today than we were last year. And more renters than ever are cost burdened today than they were last year. And that includes seniors and children who are increasing experiencing instability. Today there are 114,131 households without an affordable and available home. And on any given night, over 7,000 children and their families are struggling, and that makes up, our families make up 47% of our population struggling. And why is homelessness and housing insecurity getting worse today? In data and research shows that substantial variations in rates of homelessness across cities, across the country, they tested a range of conventional beliefs about what is driving this prevalence, from mental health and drug abuse to poverty to weather to generosity of public assistance, low income mobility, so on and so forth. And the data is very clear that market conditions like the cost and availability of housing explain homelessness in our communities. And this research is clear that rent levels and rental vacancy rates are associated with regional rates of homelessness. Multiple studies show that rental prices are rising faster when there is a scarcity of available homes. And we're all feeling that. Low vacancy rates intensify competition for available units, and they're driving up our rents. There's ample evidence that strict land use regulations contribute to this housing shortage. Recently, Minneapolis has been lauded for holding down rents. Flat rent growth in Minneapolis versus the rest of the state is attributed to the friendly development policies. Yet in most cities and map after map, as we discussed before, that most development space is restricted to the most expensive type of housing, large single unit detached homes. And apartments can offer more affordable housing solutions. They are homes. But local zoning codes severely limit where multifamily can be built and the number of home per acre that can be developed, severely restricting where multifamily can be built and unnecessarily limiting the size and supply. So to the bill, what this bill will do is put an end to our outdated and artificial exclusionary policies, and it will unleash the opportunities in every community. And I just wanted to also note that this work is the product and fingerprints of many, many hours consulting with colleagues and with many different coalitions and cities and counties and planners, BIPOC-led organizations, affordable housing partners, and more. Some of the big changes that you'll see is definition of what is multifamily, that is defined as 13 units or mixed-use building where at least 50% of the usable space is for residential use. I want to be very clear that this bill says that it is strictly not allowed on parcels that are for single family, only in areas that allow for commercial activity, as you'll see in section 2, that it is permitted only in areas that commercial is allowed, except for where industrial, industrial zones where commercial is not allowed. And we don't want these houses and multifamily units to be built next to a chemical plant, for example. And so that's why we have also said that they cannot be located in environmental justice zone areas. One of the big gifts for the cities that we heard in response is that they want, and we want them to have the ability to have a conditional use permit, if and only if specific circumstances of the development raise legitimate and reasonable concerns to public health, safety, and welfare. You'll also see that the projects must comply with standards, performance conditions, infrastructure requirements, local requirements around public health, safety, and welfare. So that's things like water, sewer, police, and fire. We've also set minimum height requirements based off city classification. We've gone back and reworked that cities can impose height and setback requirements that are different than what is allowed on the parcel if the multifamily development would substantially vary in compatibility and scale with surrounding properties. We also have gone back and taken up new language that on the parking that would allow additional units or spaces for compliance with the American with Disabilities Act. We have retooled the affordable housing development bonuses Only when affordable housing development is coming forward, cities have a menu of options that they can have choice and agency and flexibility to determine what works best for their cities, and also must still establish that review, administrative review process, but grounded in Section 1599, which is what cities already know, understand, and follow every single day. And finally, this bill also makes it clear that cities must follow the state, federal, and other rules in terms of historic districts and environmental regulations, so on and so forth. So with that, I'll turn it over to our testifiers and to the public who want to comment.
Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. We do have a number of testifiers, and so we are going to have a two-minute timer. So please keep your remarks to 2 minutes. If you hear a buzzer go off, please complete your thought, and then we'll move on to the next testifier. First, we have Reverend Emily Goldthwaite, Director of Congregational Organizing for Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Howard and committee members. My name is Reverend Emily Goldthwaite. I'm the Director of Congregational Organizing at Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative, a leading developer of deeply affordable housing in the metro. I'm grateful for the chance to speak in support of House File 4010 because we believe our current zoning system is part of the housing crisis, and the bill you're considering today is part of the solution. Why does a developer have a department of congregational organizing? I'll tell you, about half my job at times is to train our organizers and members of faith communities to organize around land use processes for our buildings, because we know that there will be opposition and that our current system favors the status quo. All of the communities where we develop have goals and comprehensive plans created with robust local input that compel them to approve it. Yet the process of approving each individual building invites neighbors in opposition to block them. Of the 20 multifamily buildings we have created in the past 20 years, nearly all of them have had to face some type of opposition during land use approval. I've witnessed almost half of these debates myself and mobilized hundreds of local residents to stand up for their values in land use hearings. Some of them are in this room right now. Even in Minneapolis and St. Paul and in suburbs from Hopkins to Shakopee, it is universally the same attitude of racial and class bias that pushes planning commissions and city councils from following the goals and direction of their comprehensive plan. It's especially offensive to us as people of faith. Our religions teach the wisdom of considering who is my neighbor and ensuring all people have a home. Public debates over who does and doesn't belong in a city or neighborhood reveal how far Minnesota has to go in rooting out the racial discrimination entrenched in our housing systems for generations. Because of our model, we win these fights and defend the rights of residents with low incomes, but often by a single vote. The development of quality, affordable housing in Minnesota is a lengthy and costly process at best, and the work to overcome NIMBY politics adds years and millions to it. No one can afford this. I'd love to be put out of the NIMBY fighting business, please. Least of all can people afford this who are waiting for a home today. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Daniel Lightfoot, and on deck, Evan Roberts. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Daniel Lightfoot with the League of Minnesota Cities. The League represents the collective interests of 838 member cities across the state of Minnesota. As we've discussed in this committee over the number of years, housing is a top priority for cities across the state. There are a number of greater Minnesota cities here today at the Capitol, and the tools that they deploy to meet community community-identified needs, from TIF to city finance infrastructure, city-supplied land, et cetera. They continue to pull levers to support developments with policies and resources that are locally led and locally driven to address community-identified needs. I wanted to first and foremost thank Representative Kozlowski for the numerous conversations that they have had with the League, with myself, and a number of other member cities and city officials, as well as the work and the time that you, Representative Kozlowski, and you, Chair Howard, and other members of this committee have spent in addressing city concerns with this bill. The bill is amended by the Delete Everything, includes numerous changes that reflect those conversations, and we really appreciate that the bill is now more focused and moving in the right direction. Some of those changes include important definitions that focus the scope of the bill, more reasonable height requirements, ability for cities to permit properties via conditional use permit, more reasonable administrative review process, and the influence of local choice as well in some of these decisions. While we do appreciate these changes and acknowledge that the bill is moving in the right direction, any legislation that usurps local decision-making authority on zoning for residential development continues to be concerning for the League. Given the short notice of the amendment, we haven't had all that much time to vet this language with member cities, but a few areas that we'd like to continue working with you, Representative Kozlowski, and this committee on include the fact that multifamily residential development is a permitted right in an industrial zone, despite limitations in the bill, which we appreciate, could still pose problematic. The parking restrictions are still problematic, and underbuilding of parking could cause spillover into city streets that are not designed to accommodate that dense parking. We also recommend that those limitations apply only to the multifamily residential development in the bill. We appreciate the administrative review process, which mirrors 1599, but we do think that that time limit is still unnecessary. And then just lastly, given that the middle housing language is not contained in the bill, we don't believe that the definitions of all the types of the missing middle housing legislation is necessary and should be removed to avoid confusion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Next, we have Evan Roberts, and on deck, Jill Huttmacher. They can correct me when we get there. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Howard and members of the committee, my name's Evan Roberts. I'm a demographer, and I've taught urban history and sociology at the University of Minnesota since 2010. My testimony is informed by my work, but doesn't represent an official position of the university. I'm here to support House File 4010 and the wave of new housing options that it will afford if passed. As part of collaborative efforts to develop a national zoning atlas, I've reviewed over 100 Twin Cities area zoning codes. I sleep very well at night, and I'm working to expand this to cover the majority of Minnesota's population. Through this work, I've seen in detail how cities handle the apparently simple question of whether it's okay to allow people to live in areas where they've said it's okay to have stores and offices. The reason why I support this bill and why it's so necessary is that cities handle this straightforward question in a myriad of different ways that make it really difficult for us to build the housing we need in Minnesota. Let's take the simple question of whether you can build an apartment in a neighborhood commercial area, the smaller scale commercial zone that cities allow, banks, groceries, small grocery stores, etc. In St. Louis Park, you can do this by right. In Maplewood, you need a conditional use permit. In Woodbury, you need a planned unit development. And in Lakeville, you can just build senior housing or an animal kennel, but not apartments or condos for people of different ages. This hodgepodge of restrictions acts to make it hard to build housing. This bill is a common sense approach. It's simplifying this mess, balancing the need to increase housing while maintaining some local authority to regulate projects for legitimate health and safety concerns. The legislature has the power on this topic, as many others, to set standards that benefit the state as a whole. We do this in lots of areas of governance, from education to public safety, and this bill does the same for homes, giving cities the opportunity to move on from the standards that the state has set. In this instance, our problem as a state is building enough housing for a growing population, and a population that's increasingly in smaller households. Allowing Minnesotans to build new homes near existing stores and offices is a straightforward way of finding new land for homes in areas that can already support them. Thank you for your action on this important matter.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, Jill Huttmacher, and on deck, Anya McDonald. Hope I got that right. Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Howard and members, my name is Jill Hudmacher, and I am the Director of Community Development at the City of Eagan. I'm testifying today on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities, Metro Cities, the Municipal Legislative Commission, which together represent cities across the state, including the City of Eagan. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I would like to thank the author of this bill for listening to concerns raised by cities and revising the proposed language. We appreciate you considering our feedback throughout the process. However, I would like to highlight a few key concerns that cities have with the language of this bill. The bill takes away a fundamental city authority, zoning and land use, which impacts the ability of cities to plan healthy communities. As an example, the bill language allows multifamily development in commercial industrial districts, which often lack parks, sidewalks, and nearby schools and services, and are impacted by heavy truck traffic, noise, and smells. Cities plan for new development through their comprehensive plans. It's a big document that usually takes about 3 years to put together, and many, many, many tens of thousands of dollars. Despite being a developed city, Eagan has added over 2,100 residential units in the last 10 years. This includes 400 subsidized and naturally occurring affordable units. An additional 350 units are approved, and nearly 500 units are in a state-mandated environmental review right now. Yesterday evening, after a year-long planning process, the Eagan City Council adopted a small area plan for former office properties surrounding Eagan Central Park. The planning process included extensive public engagement. The city listened to residents' concerns. Emails and public comments gradually shifted from anger and fear to excited and hopeful. The approved plan contemplates approximately 1,000 new housing units, new residential units, in a wide variety of densities adjacent to the park and existing neighborhoods. The City of Eagan upholds this planning process, an example of the best of local land use decision making, transparent, inclusive, thoughtful, and orderly. In my years of local government, I have seen many, many development projects improved due to public input at the local level. It can take time. It can be difficult. But when residents feel heard and can participate in the decision-making process, it builds trust in government and connection to communities.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Arnie McDonald, and on deck, Mark Foster. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you, Chair Howard and members. My name is Anya McDonald. I'm a government relations specialist with Metro Cities. Metro Cities represents the collective interests of cities in the 7-county metropolitan area. We appreciate the work of Representative Kozlowski and other legislators on this bill to include language to address many concerns raised by cities. Thank you for continuing to consider the concerns of local governments as you work on this legislation. Cities across the metropolitan area are advancing affordable housing with tools and resources that best fit local needs, including plans to use the local affordable housing aid passed last year to support housing needs in their communities. I would like to briefly highlight a few key issues we find with this bill as written. Many metro area cities that are primarily residential are focusing on adding to and maintaining their commercial sector to support jobs in the city that allow residents to live and work within the community and diversify their tax base. A potential redirecting of commercial property to multifamily housing may create inadvertent imbalances in these efforts. Metro Cities opposes language that allows only one minimum parking space required per residential unit. This is particularly problematic for areas not located near transit and preempts local considerations and decision making. Some provisions in the bill appear to be contradictory. For example, development needs to comply with existing infrastructure, but allows for affordable housing developments to exceed maximum dimensional standards imposed by city official zoning controls. The proposed legislation ignores the role of local comprehensive plans, which all metropolitan cities have in effect and that guide development for the long term and allow cities to effectively plan for infrastructure. We look forward to working with the author and the committee as this bill moves forward and appreciate the changes made to the bill language this far. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Mark Foster, and on deck, Bradley Peterson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mark Foster. I am the Vice President of Legislative and Political Affairs with Housing First Minnesota. We are a trade association of nearly 1,000 members of the home building industry that advocate for housing policy that advances housing options for all Minnesotans. As the committee has talked in depth this legislative session, our housing market is chronically undersupplied. We need an all-hands-on-deck approach to our crisis, and this language is a part of that. Minnesota's housing shortage is 106,000 units short, four times the amount of construction we had in 2023. A shortage of this size is going to take many years to eliminate. No, or trust us, we've got this, is some of the commentary that we've heard around the housing supply issue recently. Respectfully, that's not an answer to our housing shortage and affordability issues. A balanced market of available homes and homebuyers provides stable price appreciation, along with entry into the housing market for first-time homebuyers. Similarly, a balanced rental market provides affordability and accessibility to renters. We need housing abundance that leads to housing options and affordability. As our housing crisis's largest factor is a supply-demand imbalance, solutions must address the barriers to adding supply. Recently, President Biden told the National League of Cities last week, quote, "The bottom line is we have to build, build, build. That's how we bring housing costs down for good," end quote. Many other states have passed similar policy to this here before you today, including Florida, Montana, Oregon, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin. Other states that are currently considering this policy include Arizona, Ohio, Maryland, North Carolina, and more. You notice that this is a slate of both blue and red states. This should be a bipartisan issue. This is Minnesota's moment. In conclusion, Minnesota's housing market is dramatically undersupplied. For the sake of the next generation of homebuyers and renters, we need to find every possible way to create good housing policy that allows for the creation of more homes of all kinds. Thank you for the opportunity to support the bill.
Thank you.
Next, we have Bradley Peterson and then Libby Murphy.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Bradley Peterson, here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. As I indicated the last time I testified in front of the committee, you talk to any city official in Greater Minnesota, and I can tell you that they are bending over backwards and going to great, great, great lengths to accommodate housing in their communities. We very much appreciate the changes that have been made to this bill since it was first heard as an amendment to House File 4009. We very much appreciate the acknowledgement that adequate infrastructure needs to be considered by the development contemplated in this bill. We also note that more flexibility is given to cities to choose from a menu of certain special considerations rather than being mandated to accept them on the bill's terms. Finally, while we still bristle at the state imposing height regulations on development rather than allow cities to make these decisions, we do acknowledge that the ones outlined in this bill are much, much more reasonable than as originally drafted. We do, however, have a number of concerns. I think I would just basically highlight endorse everything that Mr. Lightfoot said and Ms. McDonald said from the League of Cities and Metro Cities. One item that I want to drill down a little bit deeper on, though, relates to what Ms. McDonald raises in terms of cities building out and supporting their commercial areas. We are concerned about the potential loss of commercial spaces in our downtowns and main streets. Loss of the goods and services they provide, the impact on the character of the area as a destination for locals and visitors alike, and most significantly, the potential loss of tax base as property shifts from commercial to residential are all concerns. I think as we go forward through the legislative process, we'd like to continue to work with the committee and with Representative Kozlowski to address this issue in particular. We also have concerns about the parking restrictions in the bill as well. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on this bill. We're happy to continue to work with the author to address our ongoing concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Libby Murphy. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, my name is Libby Murphy. I'm the Director of Policy at the Minnesota Housing Partnership. The reason why 3,000 children, according to the Wilder study that was just released today, lived in shelters, transitional housing, or outside last October is because there's simply not enough homes. The data is conclusive. Homelessness is a result of housing shortage. The reason why more than half of all renters are paying more than they can afford for housing, which is the most we've seen in our state of housing reports, is because the competition for housing is driving rent growth. Minnesota Housing Partnership and Habitat for Humanity of Minnesota recently released Revitalizing Minnesota report after months of convening various stakeholders. The aim of these convenings was to strategize how to maximize last year's historic investments. We were worried that we couldn't utilize these resources in every community because of restrictive growth and exclusionary zoning policies. Oftentimes, communities develop plans that say they will address housing, but the zoning isn't updated to match these plans. Parcels for multifamily are on the periphery, and they are not integrated into areas with amenities. For affordable housing in particular, the status quo is not working. In one community, a market rate project moved forward across the street. The affordable housing project was denied at the same time. In another community, a market rate project was great for the community. When economy shifted and the developer added affordable housing, the project was out of character and too large. In community after community, but multifamily parcels are often not near amenities. They are sometimes isolated across freeways. And zoning hearings are not often about zoning, but they are about those people and how these projects don't fit community character. To further fair housing, we need more housing of all types in every community. Minnesotans deserve choices, but this is not the case for lower income Minnesotans. This bill will unleash opportunities in every community, and this bill will put an end to exclusionary housing policies. Because today is Homeless Day on the Hill, I want to point out that communities are fining people who are experiencing homelessness. People are being criminalized for experiencing homelessness, and it is to no fault of their own. It is the lack of housing in these same communities. I have testified before about the importance of our local partners, and sometimes that they do things better than the state, and sometimes they know better than the state. However, on this issue, the legislature can no longer sanction practices that make it this hard to overcome our housing crisis. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify? If not, we can go to member discussion. And I would note, members, that we did hear a version of this bill. So I'm going to hope to move to a vote by 4:15 so we can move a few other bills as well. Up first, Representative Dotson.
Thank you, Chair Howard, Representative Kozlowski. Question I've got is, will this provision continue to move along with 4009, or will this be extracted out?
I think I can take that, Representative Dotson. You know, the legislative process, you get as many irons in the fire as possible, and so we have a proposal that was sent out that has them combined. This is a bill that would have it as a standalone.
Thank you.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. One thing I love to hear was that, you know, that you've really been working with a lot of different people, and I think you can really tell from the version that came back. So I want to give you a lot of credit for that. I think the bill is heading in the right direction, and, you know, from, you know, looking at my cities, you know, the people in my district, I just want to say thank you for that, for the directions it's heading, and, you know, I'm hopeful to see that it keeps moving. So thanks.
Representative Johnson. Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Kowalski, I want to thank you for actually working with trying to make this bad bill a little better. I think it still has a long ways to go, as we heard from the cities. They spend a lot of time and money on their comprehensive plans with a lot of input from the citizens and the community itself. They are very expensive to put together. And it's planning not just for where people live. It's all the infrastructure that goes along with it, the water, the sewer lines, other things as well, sidewalks, maintenance. It all goes into that comprehensive plan. And it's really tough on especially our small cities. I know in 4009 it was set up so it was only affected cities under over population of 10,000. In this bill, that is not in there. So this is affecting even our small communities across the state. On and hearing the testimony and stuff, it looks like the biggest problem is in the mostly in Minneapolis. From what I was reading between the lines of the testifiers. So as this goes forward, I think it's a good experiment to look at, but I don't think it should be mandated across the state. Maybe we want to look at Minneapolis pushing this, see how it works there. Because I think there's some problems that's really going to affect our small cities across the state and actually make it worse for them, more expensive. They're working hard to get in commercial industrial already, and then it can really affect that process as well with the infrastructure they put in. So I do hope I have a feeling this is going to be moving forward, and if it does, I hope you'll consider looking at those issues.
Representative Kozlowski.
Great. Representative Johns, Chair Howard and Representative Johns, I appreciate that, the comments and the encouragement to continue to work with many, many partners on this, which many of you know we'll continue to do that. It's been many hours of log rolling and get to a place where this is going to work for that statewide approach. I just want to say that I think that's one of the benefits of untangling the bill or being heard on its own merits, because this bill always applied statewide. And while there are different menu of options based off of the city classification, this was part of the original House File 4009 as having that statewide and not exempting Greater Minnesota, though this bill allows for the nuances to be able to be right-sized by communities. So appreciate that.
Vice Chair Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kozlowski, for bringing forward this bill. I really just want to commend you again for the work that you've done with each of the stakeholders. I think as we've heard from folks, this bill is definitely moving in the right direction. I think it's, you know, at a place where we need to be to start to move forward about figuring out how we can continue to build more housing for more people in areas where they want to live, that's closer to their jobs, closer to healthcare, closer to schools, really building the communities that we want to see. It's also noticeable that this is for every city. I think we have people from across the great state of Minnesota in this room today who are here to hear about this bill, support this bill. So I think that is a tremendous achievement, ensuring that the housing crisis is all over the state. Finally, kind of my question to a lot of the cities is, one point that came up was this idea that the state is imposing on local control. And while sometimes local control, I think, makes a lot of sense, I think we also have to look at the history of local control and what that's led to, particularly in our housing market. And so I think what this bill does and others that have been proposed is, can the state create a baseline to ensure that everyone has fair and equal access to the housing market? And I think that this is what this bill is trying to do, while also providing those menu of options so that local cities can figure out what works best for them. I did have one other point I want to make, but I forgot it. But at this time, I think I'll just leave it at that.
Representative Cha.
Thank you so much for the work that you put into this. And, I think it's shaping up to be a good bill. I just want to make a comment. And the comment is, as we move forward in building more houses for Minnesotans, we need to think about the owner-occupied piece of this and how real estate is being purchased and sold, right? We have a company that owns 36,000 homes in the United States of America. It's being traded on the stock market, right? Blackstone has a $2.5 billion fund and a reserve of $10 billion waiting to buy more homes. As we move forward in this issue, I hope that we can address it also, but I commend your work and your passion for affordable housing in Minnesota. Thank you.
And I'll go to Representative Kozlowski for the last word, but just wanted to say a few words myself. One, to thank Representative Kozlowski. We've spent a lot of quality time together over the last several weeks working on not only this bill, but 4009 as well. And want to thank cities for being engaging with us, providing feedback that's now reflected as part of this bill. And I want to thank the cities that are working hard to build more housing. The folks here from Egan shared some really important progress. But what I want to highlight is no one city alone can solve our housing crisis. We have a statewide housing crisis. And despite the progress we've made in terms of getting feedback from cities, if I were to, you know, quantify the feedback we've heard from cities on this work and the missing middle work, it's that we're doing enough. We're doing enough. Members, we are not doing enough to build homes in the state of Minnesota. If we continue with the status quo, we will never solve our housing crisis. And so I commend Representative Kozlowski for bringing this bill forward and for our work to make sure that we reject the status quo and make Minnesota a place where folks have access to a safe and stable home, because what we're doing right now doesn't cut it. Representative Kozlowski, to the final word to the bill.
Thank you, Chair Howard and members. And thinking about, you know, we're a state that we decided and we made that decision that kids in our state deserve a free lunch, that they deserve to be fed when they go to school and have full bellies, that we're a state that has set forth that we would have body sovereignty and protect the health care of all peoples. And what this bill is really saying is that taking a step forward to say that every single Minnesotan, no matter your age, your race, your income, your ability, that we should be able to live in the communities that we love and where we want to make a life and in the homes that we want. And what this bill is really doing is setting forth that we already do by right status for single family homes, and that it is really giving choice and flexibility and agency and autonomy to communities, and making sure that our communities actually have the tools that they need to put forth more affordable housing, save time and money, and get this online for Minnesotans who desperately need it. We're also taking into the challenges and the very real infrastructure struggles, the parking, all of these as we transform our systems. And so as we've gotten your support when we came here a couple of weeks ago for this bill, and now I'm asking your support to move this forward, that we can continue to work on those. As somebody with a business background who worked in cities, it's really important to me that we preserve our main streets, that we take care of our commercial spaces, and also this is an opportunity to increase tax bases and put that residential to work for our communities in a way that's not happening right now. So members, I really ask for your support. And this is a very good bill and a very important one for Minnesotans.
With that, Representative Kozlowski renews the motion that House File 4010, as amended, be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Nay.
The motion carries, and House File 4010 is on its way to State and Local Gov. Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. Members, we have two more bills. There are two bills that we've already heard that we need to take up to send to different committees or to the General Register. And the next one is Representative Norris's bill, House File 3800. Representative Norris, would you like to move your bill and remind the committee just briefly about it?
Yes, Chair Howard, I move House File 3800. As you indicated, we've already heard and discussed this bill previously. It relates to creating a new corporate entity in Minnesota specifically for housing cooperatives. At the time, I explained that housing cooperatives right now in Minnesota are kind of like trying to fit square pegs into round holes. We're trying to use our ag co-op statutes, our utility co-op statutes, our HOA statutes, and this would create a specific corporate form that is well suited to housing co-ops to allow us to create new housing co-ops more effectively, and if existing housing co-ops wanted to, they could convert to to this new corporate form. We're doing a couple things today. We'd like to send it to the House floor. I believe there are a couple of amendments we're going to take up. I'll also acknowledge that in the interim, since we last heard this bill, we got some feedback from the real property section of the bar. The stakeholders have been working together very constructively. My understanding is that an agreement has been reached to help address that feedback. That agreement is not ready for today, but that agreed to language will be reflected when the bill actually comes to the House floor.
Thank you, Representative Norris. And Representative Norris has moved that House File 38 be recommended to be placed in the General Register. So first, Representative Norris, I understand you have the A5 amendment. Would you briefly describe it?
Chair Howard, the A5 is actually a secondary amendment to the A4. So we might want to move the A4 first. Chair Howard, I can explain a little bit further if it's helpful.
Please do
just for the committee.
Yep.
So the A4 amendment, the A5 amendment basically would amend lines 1.7 to 1.9 of the A4 amendment that Lee Johnson is planning to offer. Our plan is to accept the A4 as a friendly amendment after we amend it with the A5.
So I had on my notes that Representative Johnson was moving the A4. That's how we got a little out of order. So do you want to present it, or did Representative Norris kind of capture it for us there?
I can present the A4 quick.
Okay, please do, Representative Johnson.
The A4 deals with the board meetings, making sure that things are recorded, and that an explanation why the action was taken.
All those in favor of the A4, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A4 is adopted.
We needed to.
Geez, we're moving too quick here. Let's rewind here a little bit.
I'll make a motion to reconsider the A4.
Representative Johnson makes a motion to reconsider the A4. All right, we have the A4 before us. And Representative Norris.
No.
Now you want to move the A3?
No, the A5.
The
A5.
Okay.
Yes.
We're gonna get there, folks.
Mr. Chair, I do believe that you have to act on the motion to reconsider.
You have to act. Yes, right. Okay. So all those in favor to reconsider, say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. Thank you. Now, Representative Norris, would you move the A5?
Yes, Chair Howard, I move the A5 amendment.
With the A5 before us, all those in favor of the A5, say aye.
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 Opposed? The A5 is adopted. Now to the amendment before us.
Chair Howard, members, as Lee Johnson described, the now amended A4 just specifies that board meetings must be open to the members. If for some reason the board takes action that is not open to the members, they have to document why that action was not taken in an open meeting.
Any discussion? All those in favor of the A5, say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Oh. As amended?
The A4 as amended.
Excuse me. All those in favor of the A4 as amended, say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. Thanks for your patience with the chair today here on deadline week. Next, Representative Johnson, do you have the A3 amendment?
Chair Howard, I do have the A3 amendment. It deals on page 41, line 24. It deletes the word otherwise and makes it a little more clear that the whole reading of that subdivision is regular meetings shall be held annually at a time determined by the board unless more frequent meetings are provided for in the bylaws.
Representative Norris?
Chair Howard, Lee Johnson, thank you for bringing forward this amendment. I am accepting it as a friendly amendment and encourage members to vote yes.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Norris, any remarks before we send your bill to the floor?
Nothing further, Chair Howard.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just going to request this, and certainly you can do as you wish, but since this bill isn't really the form in which we want it to leave here, but we're into deadlines, I'm requesting once that amendments and whatever is making it final for the floor, is it possible for us to have at least an informational meeting about it?
I'm definitely open to that. Okay. Let's have conversations. Sure. Yeah. Any other discussion?
Chair Howard and Lead Petersburg, if it's any assurance, and I'm not necessarily opposed to an informational hearing, I don't think that it's going to, you know, change the bill in any radical way. It has to do with how this new statute would relate to 515B, which is the common interest ownership statute. We can definitely talk to you offline, and if everybody believes it's necessary, we can do an informational hearing as well.
Representative Petersburg.
Mr. Chair, I'm just concerned that in the process in which we send bills that we know aren't ready to go to the floor, even though this committee is responsible for the final outcome, and so I'm just more concerned about the process. Thank you.
All right. So Representative Norris renews the motion that House File 3800, as amended, be recommended to be placed in the general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? And the motion carries as amended, and House Bill 38 heads to the general register. All right, one more bill, and I'll head up and turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Gbadje.
Okay, as Chair Howard moves up, I will go ahead and say, Chair Howard, do you move that your bill, House File 4735, be referred to the Capital Investment Committee?
Yes, that is my motion.
All right. Chair Howard moves that House File 4735 be referred to the Capital Investment Committee. I also understand that you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move and describe the amendment?
Yes, I have the A1 is a technical amendment that we're moving at suggestion of. This is what we have here is the Minnesota Housing Finance Policy Bill, and so it's just a technical change.
Okay. Do you want to describe the technical change any further?
We're just removing MMB language that's unnecessary in the amendment.
All right. Thank you. Any further discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. I don't think there's – do you need any other further testifiers?
No testifiers. Okay. I'll just mention that we heard this. This is the MHFA policy bill. Out of an abundance of caution in talking with staff, we're going to send this to capital investment as well. And so that's why we're back here to move it.
Okay. Any further discussion to the bill? All right, seeing none. Any final remarks? Seeing none. Chair Howard renews the motion that House File 4735, as amended, be referred to the Capital Investment Committee. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 4735, as amended, is referred to Capital Investment Committee. Any final announcements before we adjourn?
Just thank members for their work, and this will be the final meeting of the week for housing.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Thank you, committee members. No further business before us. We are adjourned.